Bazile versus Aetna Casualty Insurance Company. Ready to hear from petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Lester Fleming will present argument for petition.
May it please this honorable court, this is a summary judgment case involving a fire insurance loss in which the trial court and the court of appeals, 14th Court of Appeals, held that the suit was barred by limitations. The limitations being in the policy of insurance, which provided that the lawsuit must be started within 2 years and 1 day after the cause of action accrues. Mrs. Bazile had carried a fire insurance policies with four insurance companies on her commercial building in Houston in a total amount of $50,000. The four companies were the Lumberman's Mutual Insurance Company and their policy $15,000, Aetna Casualty Insurance Company in the amount of $15,000, General Accident Insurance Company, $10,000. An American Indemnity Company, $10,000. The total amount was $50,000. And Mr. Bazile settled now with two of the companies, Lumberman's Mutual Insurance Company and the American Indemnity Company. And those two companies are no longer in this litigation. The other two companies, Aetna Casualty Insurance Company and the General Accident Insurance Company, have not settled, and those two companies are still parties to this litigation. The fire occurred in April the 17th, 81, over 9 years ago, and caused damage to the building of about $40,000. This lawsuit was started April the 11th, 85. Mrs. Bazile hired a public adjuster to represent her in this fire loss. And the public adjuster submitted proof of loss to the insurance company's adjuster. They had employed General Adjustment Bureau, and Ms. Niemann there was the adjuster on the case. The public adjuster submitted to Ms. Niemann the proof of loss on August the 8th, 81. And they were rejected by him August the 11th, 81, on the basis that the documents were not submitted within 91 days after the loss. But negotiations continued between the public adjuster and the insurance company adjuster. However, the public adjuster resigned in the late 81. In early 82, Mrs. Bazile started to talk to the adjuster and try to work out with him a settlement. The evidence showed that Mrs. Bazile had been misled by the adjuster, who had assured her that he would settle this case in fair manner and do right by her. And she believed him and relied upon him and was convinced that he would do the right thing by her. And that's why this lawsuit was not started more promptly. The basic question here is, when did the cause of action accrue in this case? In other words, when did limitations begin to run in this case? It is clear that the moving party has the obligation and the duty to prove conclusively the exact date on which limitation begins to run. And if the moving party fails to sustain that burden of proof, then summary judgment is not proper.
Are you familiar with the recent case of Marino out of this court?
No, I'm not. The evidence presented, pardon me.
When the insurance carrier rejected the claim as being untimely filed, their letter contained the statement that the company at interest neither admits nor denies liability. What does that mean in the context of this litigation?
It means, Your Honor, that the insurance company did not deny liability, and apparently they would continue to negotiate with the insured. The evidence presented by the moving party in this case did not show any definite date on which limitation began to run. And for that reason, we would submit that the summary judgment was not proper. I cite two cases in my application, both of which indicate that the court reversed because of the moving party's failure to indicate clearly and definitely the exact date on which limitation began to run. Those cases were Jones versus Cross, decided by the First Court of Appeals, and Delgado versus Burns, decided by this court. The 14th Court of Appeals held that limitation began to run 60 days after the proof of loss was rejected by the insurance company. This view, we would submit, is not sound because at that time the loss was not due and payable since the amount of the loss had not been determined at that time. The extent of damage to the building had not been determined at that time. The cost of repairs to the building had not been determined, and no repairs had been made to the building at that time. As the
Are you familiar with Murray versus San Jacinto?
Yes, Your Honor. As I interpret that case, this court has held that limitation begins to run at the time that the insurance company denies coverage or denies liability. And that's the point I'm trying to make in this case here. Likewise, that we believe that that case should apply here and that this court should reverse because the insurance companies did not prove clearly in their evidence the exact date on which limitation began to run because they had failed to show the precise date when that may have happened. And because they failed to do so, that they have failed to sustain their burden of proof.
Well, have they shown it ever happened? We're not just talking about precision, are we? I mean, in your position is that they've never shown that the coverage was denied, that the claim was denied, and
I don't know. That is true. I don't know, Your Honor, when the claim was decided and rejected, definitely denied by the insurance company.
It's not a question whether it was in January or June. Your position is that it never happened.
Well, I'm saying, Your Honor, that they failed to present evidence to show clearly and definitely the exact date. I might also point out, Your Honors, that the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case is also in conflict with the decisions in Trinity Universal Insurance Company and Republic National Life Insurance Company, both of which cases cited in my application. In both of those cases, the court held that limitation did not begin to run until liability was denied by the insurance companies. I would submit, Your Honors, that the better and more equitable view is that the determination to be made as to when liability is denied as a basis for deciding when the insurance company has determined definitely their liability. So in this case here, I point out, Your Honors, that the better view is that the insurance company should be required to deny liability clearly and definitely before the limitation begins to run. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear arguments from the court.
May it please the court, Mr. Stephen Pate and Mr. Scott Chase will present arguments for respondent. Mr. Pate will open.
May it please the court, I intend to take 10 minutes and then turn it over to Mr. Chase for the additional 5 minutes for argument. I agree with Mr. Fleming in this respect. This case is about when the cause of action proves.
Counsel, where in the contract is established when the time begins to run?
There's a win-loss payable clause, Your Honor, that says that 60 days after proof of loss is filed is when the loss becomes due and payable. We believe, and that is when the right to sue vested. There's been some talk about the Murray case, and I'll hit that head on as far as what our position regards that. Murray is a bad faith case. It talks about denial being the trigger for a bad faith cause of action. Limitations run. We believe that this case is based on the contractual language. The win-loss payable clause that says 60 days after proof of loss, and then you go to the 2 years and 1 day provision of the policy. Under this construction...
So can they just send in a new proof of loss and then wait 60 days and sue?
That would take us to another position. That would take us to the position where there would be waiver and estoppel, because the insurance company might have to deal with that proof of loss. It might have to get into a situation that might concern the Howard case. The record here is clear.
So under your contract, you don't ever have to act. You can keep writing them letters and saying, we'll decide next week, we'll decide tomorrow, hang on by your mailbox. Keep waiting, and if you can do that 2 years in a day, then you win.
You know, that probably is exactly what might happen if you accepted denial as the standard. Here, the policy says that 60 days after proof of loss is when the cause of action accrues. That gives the insured a reasonable expectation of when his claim can either be paid or denied.
So if you're still saying you haven't decided in 2 years and 60 days, he knows at that point to sue.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If you still claim you haven't made a decision in 2 years and 60 days, at that point he knows to sue.
No, Your Honor, what I'm saying is that 60 days after the proof of loss, they've got the right to sue, and that right to sue continues for 2 years and 1 day. The best case on this point is still the Lew Allen case, which is out of the Court of Appeals of Eastland. In that case, the insurance company wanted to establish denial as the basis, and the insured said no, it's 60 days after proof of loss. In that case, the Court of Appeals said, we're going to construe this against the insurance company, and we're going to say 60 days after proof of loss. The uncontroverted facts here show that 60 days after proof of loss was October 8, 1981, and therefore she had until October 9, of 1983 to file suit. Therefore, we hold that her filing suit in April 1985 was untimely. The record is completely silent as to any negotiations that Mr. Fleming talks about. There was an affidavit that we submit was not proper summary judgment proof, not timely filed as a response. But even if you accept that affidavit, it says absolutely nothing about lulling this lady to sleep.
Are there any public policy concerns when private parties set limitations?
Well, Your Honor, the state of Texas allows us to do that in the Texas Civil Practices and Remedies Code. And I think that as far as the public policy is concerned, when the legislature said that you could have a statute of limitations or contractual limitations that is just 1 day more than the 2 year period, I think they satisfy the public policy concerns.
But can it start before it would start under the common law?
I'm sorry, sir,
the measuring period, I understand you can set 2 years in 1 day, but can you have the startup period start before it would occur at common law without violating the public policy?
As I understand your question, sir, before it would begin at common law, the cause of action would accrue when facts are available to let someone know that their right to sue vests. And therefore, I don't think that could possibly happen, if I understand your question correctly.
Why isn't the paragraph, the 60-day paragraph that you referred to, why aren't there two conditions there? 60 days after proof of loss and ascertainment either by agreement expressed in writing or by filing an award.
The two conditions there, Your Honor, I think can be read separately. And in fact, I think they have been from the Blue Island case and from Standard Insurance Company versus Freeman. Freeman is different from this case, as I think the Court of Appeals pointed out, in that there was a continuing rental loss and also there was an appraisal agreement. There was basically agreement on liability. Here there was no agreement on liability. Here there was a letter rejecting the proof of loss, no agreement concerning liability.
So, to take the language of the policy, it has never happened that there has been an ascertainment of the loss made either by agreement between the insured and this company expressed in writing or by the filing with the company of an award as provided herein. That has never happened.
That has never happened, Your Honor. There has never been any request for appraisal in the record. And we believe that that's what that portion is talking about.
And why isn't that part of the requirement of when setting the time when the cause of action accrued?
We ought to look at the obverse. Would limitations ever run if you applied that? And it probably never would. And I don't think that's reasonable or fair to both parties. But really, when you get down to this policy,
it would run if the insurer would send the insured a note and say, we deny your claim. And then it would run under this clause and any other way you could think of it.
And that would put an affirmative obligation on the insurance company to deny the claim when the insured has got the duty and obligation to prove his loss. The record here is silent that as to anything occurring after this rejection of the proof of loss. There's nothing happened until he filed suit, obviously thinking that the four-year statute of limitations for contracts would apply.
Counsel, following up on what Justice Heck has said, the policy provides that the insured cannot even bring suit unless all the requirements of the policy have been complied with. And using the number one and number two step he referred to, it appears that they've never been complied with, so the claimant couldn't bring suit.
Your Honor, that is not the way we read Freeman. We read Freeman as involving a continuing loss and an appraisal agreement. Llewellyn dealt with that, we think, by saying 60 days after proof of loss.
Doesn't this appear to you to be somewhat ambiguous?
No, Your Honor, not when you examine the cases that have developed since in the area.
And the insured's supposed to take your language, put the judicial gloss on it by keeping up with the Eastland Court of Appeals.
No, Your Honor, we're not saying that. This lady had a public adjuster who's familiar with this policy. We could presume was. This is the New York Standard Fire Policy that's been in effect in Texas for many years.
Is this language mandated by the Insurance Commission?
Yes, sir. Every fire policy in the state of Texas has to be passed by the State Board of Insurance.
Well, could you have different language here, or is this the only loss payable clause that's permitted?
This is the only loss payable clause that is permitted. It appears in Texas standard forms. Your Honor, as I see that the green light is on for myself, and I thank you. I've been honored to appear before you.
Any questions? Any further questions? Thank you.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chase will continue arguing for respondent.
May it please the Court, the Honorable Justices. There are a few things I'd like to touch on here, and then I'd like to respond to some of the questions that were asked of my colleague. First and foremost, there seems to be some problem as to the question of the ambiguity in the loss payable clause. And I think we need to look at the entire clause and then look at what triggers the loss payable clause, because I think we're in a position where we put the cart ahead of the horse. If you look at the loss payable clause, it says the amount of loss which this company will be liable for shall be payable 60 days after proof of loss as provided herein. Okay. So you have to go back and look at the proof of loss clause. The proof of loss clause in this policy says within 91 days after the loss, unless such time is extended in writing, the insured shall render to the company a proof of loss signed and sworn to by the insured. In order to get to the loss payable clause, the first condition in the policy must be complied with. That was not complied with here. The uncontroverted summary judgment evidence proven up by the affidavit and letter of Mr. Niederman was that the 91 days was not complied with. At that point in time, the company sent a letter, and that letter states, your proof of loss is rejected. And they also put the standard insurance policy language in there, which is, the company neither admits liability nor denies liability. The reason is simple. At that point in time, the insured must come forward and make a proper proof of loss. How does he do that?
Well, wait a minute. You're saying they did not file anything within 91 days?
That's correct.
As required by your policy?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why then do you... But you gave them another opportunity.
Well,
are you required to do that, or just by your grace?
Well, the clause which is put in there, neither admits liability nor denies liability, is for a reason.
But you invited them to make another proof of loss.
It can be construed that way, yes, Your Honor.
Which you then say, under this clause, you're free to reject, even if it's the world's most perfectly formulated proof of loss. You can say, well, you didn't meet the 91 days.
Well, I think we're jumping ahead and speculating. The evidence in this case is that there was never any subsequent proof of loss. Now, there are certain proofs of loss which are curable, whether it was sworn to, whether it was properly signed, whether it was specific enough in detail, whether or not they filled out why the fire occurred. Okay? And then there are other ones which are not curable, which is a time requirement, which is you didn't file it within 91 days. Okay, what is the insurer's option at this point? The insurer's option is, well, I can come back, I can argue waiver, I can argue estoppel, I can show conduct on the part of the insurance company, which led me to believe that my claim was going to be accepted. I can refile another proof of loss and explain to them why the first proof of loss was late. There are options available to the insured, which the insured did not take in this case. If we go back, what we're arguing about here is this simple two-page response to the motion for summary judgment and the affidavit of the plaintiff. And it sets forth six factual issues that they say are in dispute. The first one, when the plaintiff gave notice of the loss to the four insurance companies. Well, the plaintiff's affidavit says, I gave notice of the loss immediately. We don't contest that. There's a notice of loss, and then the next condition that you have to go by is the filing of a sworn proof of loss. It's specific in the policy what's required within 91 days, unless extended in writing. The evidence is it was not filed within 91 days. The evidence is there's nothing in writing to extend that time period. And at that point, the company rejected the proof of loss, as it was their contention that the condition of the policy was not complied with. The next factual issue that they set forth was, when was proof of loss submitted by the plaintiff to the four insurance companies? The only evidence before the trial court was the affidavit of Mr. Niederman and the letter which he sent to the insured, which says, we received your proof of loss on August 8, 1981. The policy requires 91 days, sworn proof of loss. You did not comply with that condition. So that's the only evidence that the court had before it at the trial court level. The next factual issue that they're alleging, when was proof of loss accepted and or rejected by the four insurance companies? There's no question when the proof of loss was denied. The letter is specific. We are rejecting your proof of loss. Letter's dated August 11th of 1981. So that's the date that the proof of loss was rejected. Now, whether or not that was a correct rejection is not before this court. Now, if they had filed suit within 2 years and a day, there could have been a determination by a court and by a fact-finding body as to whether or not the companies acted properly in insisting on this 91-day clause. That's not the issue.
But it is true that to this very hour, the insurers, the three of the four who remain in the case,
two of the four,
have never denied the claim.
They have rejected the proof of loss. There has never been a contractual requirement of them to pay on the policy because one of the very first conditions of the policy was not met.
Yes, sir. But they've never said, we're not going to pay this claim.
That's correct.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
May it please this Honorable Court, I think it's well to remember and emphasize here that the insurance companies did fail to prove conclusively in the summary judgment petition the exact date on which limitations began to run in this case. And I think that point is fatal here to the granting of the summary judgment. May I also point out, Your Honors, that in this case we have the exact situation exactly that the Chief Justice pointed out. We have an insured who is negotiating with the adjuster after the public adjuster resigned. And in these negotiations, the insurance company adjuster led her to believe that he would do right by her, and she was lulled into believing that the case would be settled fairly and properly, and that...
Respondents say that's not in summary judgment record. Is that true?
There's an affidavit, Your Honors, in which Mr. Bazile states that she has been taken advantage of by the insurance company adjuster.
Was that raised in response to the motion for summary judgment?
I believe it was, Your Honor. So for that reason, Your Honors, it seems to me that the viewpoint of this court that the insurance company should be required to deny clearly and definitely when their liability, to deny their liability clearly and definitely, I think is a proper rule and should be applied here in this case. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument and second call.
Please rise.